Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. 50 years ago this summer, an iconic movie made its way to theaters and became a smash hit. Jaws was only the second feature film by then 26-year-old filmmaker Steven Spielberg. The young director faced production struggles due to his insistence on filming the movie on the open ocean, a balky robotic shark that refused to work properly, and two cast members, Robert Shaw and Richard Dreyfuss, that famously didn't get along real well at times on the set. But in the final analysis, Jaws is a masterpiece of filmmaking that began the trend for major Hollywood blockbusters to be released in summer. Just after the film, there was concern it might cause a backlash against actual sharks, and while that may have been true for a short period, over time the legacy of Jaws has been one of inspiring many to go into the field of marine biology in general, and sharks in particular. Our guest is a great example of that. David Ebert, similar to the shark expert character Matt Hooper in the film, has a lifelong love of the ocean and sharks. He's known as the Lost Shark Guy, and he's discovered dozens of species of sharks around the world. David is the director of San Jose State's Pacific Shark Research Center at Moss Landing Marine Labs, and like me, he's a huge fan of the movie Jaws. He joins us now to talk about it. David Ebert, welcome back to Blue Dot.
Hey, well, thanks, Dave. Happy to be back again.
Well, we're here to talk about a certain movie that came out in the summer of 1975. Can you believe it's been 50 years since Jaws came out?
I try not to think about that because I was in high school at the time when the movie came out. And but it was definitely a pretty phenomenal movie. I think it was one of the first real summer blockbusters. Because I was a teenager at the time, but I don't remember any movie like that where after I watched it, it was like, I got to go see this movie again.
Tell us about your first experience with that movie. Do you remember the first time you went to see it, like where you were and that kind of thing? Because I sure do.
Yeah, no, I do too. I grew up here in the Monterey area, and I went and saw it at the Steinbeck Theater on Cannery Row.
What a perfect place to see that film.
Oh, I know. And like I was at that time, I was big into free diving and, you know, spearfish and stuff. And I think I didn't even have my driver's license yet. I think my mom dropped me and my brother and a few friends off to watch the movie. And of course, growing up here in Monterey, you know, you kind of tuned into sharks anyway. But yeah, we went and watched the theater and it was just like a phenomenal movie. I thought, oh, man, we got to go watch this again. And so, and we did. It was just a nice first time I think it was one of the first blockbuster movies ever where people kind of came out of there and thought, like, I've got to go see this movie again. And it definitely left a big impression on us. I'd be curious what your impression was, but growing up around the ocean, I kind of took it as like kind of more of a monster movie than actually, you know, being terrified of sharks. And I think that was just being around the ocean. Did you have a similar thing?
Yes and no. I had my pump pretty well primed when I went to see it. I was 15 years old, saw it in Chico, California, the home of Blue Dot, and at the El Rey Theater when it first came out. And interesting thing about Jaws is it had a widespread release. And when Hollywood films, when they do that, that usually means they think they don't think the movie's going to do real well. But in this case, they thought, you know, we think this could be something. And they put it in a wide release, and then people went and saw it. And kind of like you said, they wanted to go see it again, and they told their friends, and it became this just huge event of the summer. It is the first Hollywood blockbuster of the summer, and it began, you know, what we see now. Where, you know, there's kind of a movie season where you have the Oscar films that are serious and sometimes a little too serious for me to really want to go see. But, you know, nowadays, you know, when summer rolls around, you know Hollywood's going to roll out the blockbusters. And that began with Jaws. They didn't know that it was going to be this big a hit. They were gambling, Richard Zanuck and Brown, the producers, on this 26-year-old film director who just had one movie out, Sugarland Express, I believe it was. And, you know, he was very young and they just thought he was very talented and, you know, rolled the dice with him. And oh my gosh, you know, the rest, as they say, is history. You know, I've heard many times from many cinema people that teach film that if you're going to watch, you know, two films, this one and that one, Jaws is often one of the ones they mention, as it's just an absolute perfect film from a filmmaking point of view.
Yeah, I you know, it was like the first time you saw it, it was like there was just so much happening, because usually most of the movies up until around there, and again, I was like about your age when I saw this, they would be like, you know, they'd build up a big suspense, and then it would kind of like, you know, you have the conclusion where there just kept being new, every like couple minutes there'd be some new, I don't know, say high point, but some suspenseful thing. And the music, I mean, it had the right music and the right scenes in there and stuff. And like the way they built up to like, because you don't see the shark till like later in the movie, really.
I read Jaws, the book by Peter Benchley, and I thought it was good and I really enjoyed it. And then it got me really interested because I already kind of had an interest in great white sharks. I remember an earlier film that came out that I saw in Santa Monica, Blue Water, White Death, which was by Peter Gimble and Ron and Valerie Taylor, who actually have some film footage that is used in the film Jaws. Of, you know, the only time you actually see real live sharks, that's the Taylors, you know, filming great white sharks, and the scenes in the shark cage with Hooper later on. Those are the only times you see a real shark. But I remember seeing that film, and then I got another book. It was a nonfiction book. I don't remember what it was, but it was, you know, it was just kind of like the publishers had decided to latch on to Jaws and let's put a book out about shark attacks. And so I read that. And so I was reading about all these gruesome shark attacks all over the world. And so I was ready for that movie when I saw it, and it scared the crap out of me. And, you know, the famous saying is, you know, people, you'll never want to go in the water again after watching that film. But I also mm-hmm. had spent so much time in the ocean that I had that sense that if I'm going to die of a shark attack, you know, okay, that's going to happen. I'm much more likely to die getting hit by a car. So I'm not going to worry about it overly.
Well, I think too is like at the time we knew so little about sharks, you know, even especially white sharks, we knew so little about them. Like there was things in there you just thought at the time, like the one that always stands out to me is the shark jumping in the back of the boat. You're just like, oh, they can't do that. So kind of almost for me, it was more of a monster movie because like, oh, sharks can't do that. Well, you know, we learned later on, you know, that, yeah, 20 years later, yeah, these sharks can actually jump.
Yeah, you had an experience like that. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, this was more around this, in the scene when the shark shows up there and the sheriff Brody's kind of like, we need it, backs up there and he goes, we need a bigger boat. The first time you really see the shark, and story I frequently tell.
Which was an ad-libbed line, by the way.
Yeah.
It was not written.
Right. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, right. Yep. That was an ad-lib line they had in there. And in doing my PhD research, I was in Namibia and we're out catching some sharks in a lagoon called Luderitz Lagoon, which is in the middle of nowhere, really. But they had a lot of sharks that I was looking for. And so we're in a rowboat in the middle of nowhere in this lagoon. And as we're catching these other sharks for this project, this research for my thesis, we had a white shark that, you know, it probably sounds bigger than it actually was, but I'd say anywhere from 12 to 15 feet came up and bit one of the sharks alongside the boat. And at that moment, I thought, we're going to die because here was a shark that was bigger than the boat. And so, I mean, I really had that moment.
Did you think of the line from the film?
Not in the moment. I was like,
okay, I can understand.
Not in the moment. It was like me and my fellow grad student there. And at the moment, you kind of like your eyes don't catch what you just witnessed with this like big shark next to your boat that was eating another shark at the time. And then we're kind of sitting there and we thought, and we looked at each other. And then all of a sudden this feeling sets in like you're going to die. And so like, and I thought we were going to die. Nobody's going to like know what happened to us because there's nobody around. And so I started rowing for shore, which was a kilometer or two away. And my friend, he was clever enough that he baited his hook, threw it back over the side, and he hooked another shark, one of those seven gill sharks. And he was playing this shark so the white shark would go after the shark in distress and not the boat. And it wasn't until after we got in, gotten to shore and made it safely out and everything, that I kind of, and later I thought about later the scene from Jaws. I thought, like, yeah, we really needed a bigger boat in that case out there,
Yeah,
because it
real
was a
in
close
real life.
call.
Yeah,
Oh yeah,
and
and
you,
it was a real life moment, like they
and
have.
that is the first time we really, get a look at the shark and get a size, a sense of its size and menacing mouth and everything, the jaws.
Well, if you remember, if you remember the other line in there, when I think one of the guy was Hooper says, like, that's a 20-footer, and Quince goes, like, it's 25. Well, like I said, the shark that I had, the first close encounter I had with a white shark, I said it was like 12 to 15 feet. Let me tell you,
That's a big fish.
12 feet or 25, it really doesn't make a big difference, because they'll either one can eat you pretty easily. So,
Oh, boy. And another thing that interesting about why I've always been had a love and fascination for great white sharks, and Jaws was kind of, was the pinnacle of that experience, because I loved and was fascinated by them before and scared of them. Was I didn't really realize that we had them in California. I always thought, well, yeah, Jaws, that happens in, Massachusetts and blah, blah, blah. And I know they're in South Africa. And then I started spending more time in the Northern California coast, and I started to find out, it's like, oh no, we've got them here, big time. This is great white shark paradise here. And it was several years ago now, but not that long ago, I was at Westport Union Landing State Beach near Westport, and they had just found the head of a guy who had been attacked by a great white shark. And it was like his head basically washed up on the beach right where I was. And it was like, I was there a day after, and everybody was talking about it. And I thought to myself, my God, that is straight out of Jaws.
Yeah, that was an abalone. I remember that attack was an abalone
Abalone
diver. So
diver.
I used to do a lot of abalone diving on the North Coast. And I went to Humboldt State for my undergrad studies. But even before that, and during and after, we used to go abalone diving up and down the coast there. A lot of times down at Fort Bragg and in Westport, all that area in there. But I was going to say, before Jaws came out, because I grew up here in the Monterey area, there have been a few attacks in the early 70s on surfers mainly. Down the coast towards Big Sur. But it was literally like a one day story, like, oh, a surfer got bit. And that was kind of, that would be it. But then, of course, as we all know, after Jaws came out, every shark sighting, every attack became like this, huge national story. And that was really the thing that changed with Jaws. And suddenly all these things became what was a one day story became like major national news.
Yeah. There was also a wonderful book that came out a few years ago about the great whites of Northern California off the Farallones by Susan Casey, called The Devil's Teeth, which I enjoyed reading very much. And she had an appropriate awe and thought they were just majestic creatures. And they are. Could you maybe just talk a little bit about great white sharks from the point of view of, as a marine biologist and shark expert? They really are magnificent apex predators.
Amazing. They're amazing to see in the wild. And I first time I really saw some was when I went to South Africa. Even though they're around the coast here, Monterey and everywhere, I never saw one, thankfully, diving. But when I went to South Africa, you would see them around there. But I was never for, thankfully, I was always in a boat or somewhere when you see them, and they're just majestic to see swimming. And then if you ever have the fortunate to see them actually when they go hunting or they attack seals, like you should probably people have watched Shark Week or some of the shark shows in False Bay in South Africa, you'll see what they can do. I mean, they're a predator like nothing I've ever seen. I mean, they are just full on when they and you see them breach out of the water, like getting back to the Jaws thing, when they jump in with the shark jumping in the boat, people couldn't think about a big shark like that breaching the water. And I remember the first time I saw that when I was in South Africa, I was just stunned. But everybody down there knew that lived in these areas where the sharks are known to breach down there around False Bay, Cape Town. And I thought, like, these guys are crazy. These sharks can't breach. And but by God, when I first time I saw them, it was amazing. And then I came home to California, and I talked to some of my professors about these sharks, white sharks breaching. And they thought, you've been drinking, you're drunk, are you stoned? And I go, no, seriously, these sharks really do breach. And it was only a few years after I left a guy named Chris Fallows, who I've since become friends with. I didn't know him at the time, but he lived there, and he went out and started filming this and became, world famous for filming these breaching white sharks down there. But it's just one of those things that, the truth is stranger than fiction, I guess. What those sharks can do, but it's just talk about raw power with those things.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our look at the iconic film Jaws on the 50th anniversary of its release with David Ebert, director of San Jose State's Pacific Shark Research Center at Moss Landing Marine Labs. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now as shark expert David Ebert and I look back at the movie Jaws as we celebrate its 50th anniversary. When Peter Benchley wrote his novel, we didn't know as much about great white sharks. Because that novel was a big sensation. Everybody was reading it. Yeah. And then it's kind of funny because, like, after Jaws, nobody read it. And you don't talk to anybody that reads Jaws, the book, anymore. The interesting thing is that after, the sensation of Jaws book and movie, he really felt a lot of guilt, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. I know him, and I've seen Steven Spielberg both express a lot of regret on the movie. I've had a different view of it. I think, I've mentioned to you before, and I've mentioned is that, there's always the sensational part of the whole Jaws thing came out, and a lot of the regret was what happened with they felt like, well, sharks are being, going out and these
demonized.
Demonized. And the thing is, some of that went on after in the late 70s and early 80s, where these guys would go out and want to catch a big shark. And then, Frank Mundus was well known in New England to go out and catch these big sharks. But, Frank had been doing that before Jaws came out. He just became more famous afterwards. And I think he was the guy that's, Quint.
Real life Quint.
The real life Quint. Yeah, he was a real life Quint, but he was doing that before the movie came out. And there's other examples where people would go out and catch these big sharks, but nobody paid any attention to them. And, they talk about, people started slaughtering all these sharks, that wasn't really true, because sharks were being caught. They're being finned. Their liver oils were being used. They're being used as food. That was going on. What Jaws really did is it brought this whole fishery, this whole industry, from out of the shadows and into the light, really, is what it did. Because suddenly people were aware of sharks, whereas before that, they didn't really care. They're kind of the only good shark's a dead shark, really, because nobody really paid any attention to them. So, I look at it a little differently than I think, like I said, and I know Peter Benchley passed away, I think, in 2006. But I never met him. I've never met Spielberg, but sure like to talk to them some. Well, certainly Spielberg.
What would you tell them from your point of view about, why you think that, what they did was just fine, and the impact that it really did have on people like you and generations of people, hey, I want to be Matt Hooper.
Yeah, well, I was actually already going to do, I was already fascinated by sharks before that, but of course Matt Hooper kind of galvanized that whole thing. Like, hey, here's a guy doing sharks. There really was no field of shark research before Jaws. Shark research was basically shark attack. And that came out of World War II, where people were like, there's these stories, like the famous ones, the Indianapolis, which Quint relays that story in the movie, talks about having been on the Indianapolis, which sank after delivering the atomic bomb, and like a lot, hundreds of sailors died. Most of the sailors actually died from exposure,
dehydration.
A few were by sharks, but the sharks caught more attention, and a lot of stories came back. And so the Navy, Office of Naval Research, after World War II and for the next 40 years, really funded shark preventive, shark attack prevention is what they really did. And it was mainly geared towards, sailors and airmen if they got stranded at sea. And that was really, and that really went on. But after Jaws came out, at that point, the late 70s, early 80s, the Office of Naval Research was winding down their shark attack stuff. But at the same time, because of Jaws, people were asking a lot of questions and about like, how old do sharks get? How many young do they have? Where do they go? How many species of shark are out there? And those were all, nobody really knew. And I was super fortunate that come the early 80s, this whole new generation, I was part of what I call the Jaws generation of young researchers that, shark attack was kind of off the table, and we were basically doing life history and ecology, studying like how many white shark or how many sharks are out there and how many, how old do they get? In fact, as a graduate student, I co-authored the first paper on the age and growth of the white shark in 1985. And so it was just a super dynamic time. In fact, in 1983, they held it, and I was just started grad school. They had a white shark conference down at California State University, Fullerton, and they had people from all over the world there, including Rod and Valerie Taylor, go there and talk about their white shark experiences. And it was just that, and that all came about because of Jaws. It probably would not have happened without the movie Jaws.
And, I was thinking about, it's really hard for me to say what's my favorite movie of all time. I've got some favorites of all time. Casablanca, Chinatown. I love The Right Stuff because of my, background with NASA. There's a lot of movies that I love. Rio Bravo with John Wayne. But there's one thing that stands out for me about Jaws is that if any of those films are on TCM or whatever, I may or may not watch them. But if Jaws is on, it's an automatic, oh, Jaws, boom, it's on. And it doesn't matter if I sit there and intently watch it or it's just on keeping me company. I don't think I've ever not watched Jaws if it was available, like just, oh, I'm hanging out on a summer afternoon. It's the ultimate summer movie and it's my all-time favorite. I think that's why it might be my number one.
Yeah, well, there's definitely some scenes in there, like the Indianapolis scene, Quint's talking about having been on the boat and why he won't wear a life jacket or anything. There's some scenes there you can watch over and over again. And I think in that scene too, there actually were when they were filming that, I think they were all drunk at the time too, actually, and in real they were actually drinking while they're filming
Yeah,
that
Robert
scene.
Shaw was dr famously drunk during the whole shoot of the movie. In fact, what's interesting about that monologue is it was written by a couple of different of the screenwriters, but he put his own spin on it. And the first time he did it, he was kind of inebriated and screwed it up. But then the next day, he changed it a bit and he nailed it in one take. And it's, I think, if you're going to say, what's the greatest monologue in the history of film? It's probably that one.
I mean,
The description of the
that,
sharks, that they've
yeah.
got lifeless eyes. There's this, oh
Right,
boy,
yeah.
it's just chilling.
Yeah, I mean, of any of the scenes in there, and there's a lot of classic scenes in
That
there,
one's a good one.
that one, and I would say when the young woman gets attacked at the beginning of the show or the beginning of the movie, I mean, that's about as realistic of an attack as you could have probably done in a movie.
Yeah, and the actress that did that, the stunt woman, whatever, they really put her through the ringer on that. They had these ropes attached to her and were dragging her all around, and she really got physically
Yeah.
beat up in that scene. And it, like you said, it's very chillingly realistic. And what's you mentioned this earlier, but one of the great things about all great horror monster type movies is you don't see the monster till late in the film. Like when I think about this, I think about Steven Spielberg as a kid watching these kinds of movies. An example would be the movie Them from the 1960s, which had a great cast. James Whitmore, Jim Arness, who went on to be, Matt Dillon in Gunsmoke, Edmund Gwynn, I think his name was, who was the Santa Claus in what's the movie about Miracle of 54th Street. It's just, it's got a great
Oh, yeah.
cast. And it's really well written, well photographed. But the ants themselves, the giant ants that have mutated from, atomic testing, that are the bad guys, the monsters in the movie, we don't see them till way late in the film to great effect because they're really not that impressive when you get to actually see them. But
No.
it's the buildup
Yeah.
when you don't see them of the
Right.
unknown that makes you just scared poopless.
Yeah, and I heard I've read this online. I don't know how I never like I said I don't really know for sure, but they had the when the young boy was killed there. I guess they had the scene was actually more
More gory,
gruesome, and
yes. They
more
decided to cut it
gory.
after a test screening that it was like
Yeah,
too much.
it was a little too much. But I thought the way they had it when the guy in the lagoon got attacked and taken out, they lost the leg and stuff was. It was kind of building up to that whole, yeah, the little boy got taken and the guy in the lagoon. And because I think that happened kind of back, if I remember right, back to back. And it was just sort of that you see a little more each time until they're out in the boat and you actually see the shark and how big it is. And then it just, yeah, and the whole suspenseful buildup was just, was well, I mean, it was really well done. I'm not a big sort of movie critic or something. I mean, I watch a movie and I either enjoy it or I don't, but, kind of, piecing it up, taking it, dissecting it a little bit. You just like there's some scenes in there that are just it was well done the way Spielberg did as far as putting the movie.
Oh, it's a master class in filmmaking, and you can if you really watch the film beginning to end and just watch every moment of it. There's not a wasted piece in there. Everything's got a purpose,
Yeah.
and there's moments where they're setting up all these different conflicts going on. You've got the mayor and the townspeople who they don't want the beaches closed because their livelihoods depend on it. And he is kind of
Yeah.
the bad guy in the story, Larry the mayor, and he really is a sleazeball. But
Yeah.
his motivation is, if we lose these beaches and nobody comes here, we're all going to be on welfare, literally.
Well, yeah. I mean, we had, I growing up in a bit of a tourist area here in Monterey, when they had, it was a little different because people aren't all in the water quite as much because the water's colder here, but people. People, when there would be a shark, there was a really well-known shark attack in the 1981 on a surfer
Oh
here that
yeah,
was
I
pretty
remember that.
horrific.
I
You
do.
might remember that one, and like that did cause a bit of an issue down here because people were like going up, even though they weren't may not be going in the water. It was like there was this pretty horrific shark attack in Monterey, and so people were kind of like, well, I think I'll go somewhere else. And so actually, it was even though the mayor in Jaws was a sleaze bag, it is a reality that these small businesses and stuff that were portrayed in the movie were and they were the, it was really the small businesses in the movie kind of said, hey, we can't afford this is our big weekend for having people come to the beach or come to out to the vineyard
Yeah,
and
July 4th to on Amity Island, and one of and there's just so many great things about this film. But we definitely need to talk about the score by John Williams. You just hear
oh
those
yeah.
two notes, and Matt will play them for us now. But they are iconic, and everybody
Oh
knows
yeah.
them. And like the Indiana Jones theme that he wrote, Star Wars, that theme. And the other thing that I would mention, though, as a film buff, is that we all know that no, and the build up and the attack scenes. There's a lot of beautiful scoring in that movie that's not that. That's also just, there's the majesty of the sea and some of the music that he uses to portray the mystery of the ocean. Because the ocean's also kind of one of the protagonists in this film, because it's also our fear of, what's under there that I can't see and I don't know about. And that leads us to our three main characters. One of the things I love about this movie is the three main characters are so perfect together. So let's dissect them a little bit. Tell me about your thoughts about, let's start with your guy. You kind of turned out to be a bit like him, our Hooper, our marine biologist. He's an interesting guy.
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, I think he was kind of he I thought well, just talking about the
Richard Dreyfuss.
Richard Dreyfuss. I mean, I think he played them just to a T. And of course at that time there wasn't really like a lot of people you could point to in the field that were like a real Matt Hooper at the time. Because there wasn't anybody like him. But the fact he comes out there and there's a point that he has a really fancy, nice boat and all this really good equipment. I think, Brody the sheriff's kind of like, are you rich? And he's like, yeah.
Me, is it me
I
or the
was.
whole family? It's like he's so matter of fact about it. And
Well,
he does
I thought it was.
represent, that's the neat thing about the three of them is he represents upper class, elite. And then you've
Yeah.
got Quint,
Right.
working class, definitely not elite. the opposite.
Right.
And that's why they are always sparring through the film, that there's this, you know, tension between them, which was also in real life on the set. They didn't get along famously during the shooting. And then, but then our main hero, Brody, is middle class. And I think, you know, his arc as a character, the more I think about him, is just beautiful.
He was kind of like the link between, say, like Quint and Hooper, and that he was like sort of the middle class sort of guy between the working and a more affluent. And they all like fit like different, almost like different segments of society in a way. And they all had to sort of band together when they were at sea. They had to bond because they had this common, I hate to use the term enemy, but this common foe, mm-hmm. maybe that they had to look at. And I've heard even people, some reviewers or people comment on it, that it was almost like, you know, it was almost like the Moby Dick thing where you had the hunt for.
Yeah. There are definite parallels between Quint and Ahab.
Yeah. And you had that same sort of dynamic, only you had these dynamic with these three individuals. And it was interesting because even like, you know, like Brody couldn't swim and Quint didn't either, but Quint wasn't going to, he just goes, yeah, I don't need a life jacket. If I go in the water, I'm just going to die, basically, very matter of factly. Whereas Brody was like, I'm going to survive one way or another. And then Hooper was kind of like, a bit of a different thing. He goes, well, I'm a marine biologist. I dive. I can do this. I can do that. You know, I'm not going anywhere. And those are the two guys that ended up surviving at the end.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, if we think about Hooper, you know, he's the one who, he's not afraid. He talks Martin Brody into going out, who's deathly afraid of the water. I mean, he doesn't even want to go out on the ferry. We definitely get a sense, right. You know, there's the scene where the guy with the weird bathing cap, the old guy gets out and says, you don't even go in the water, do you, Chief? We know that he's scared to death of the water. And, you know, there's no way he would go. And he doesn't want to go out on Richard Dreyfuss's boat, the Hooper character's boat. He has to get very, very drunk. And, you know, Hooper has to really talk him into it. But, you know, it happens really quickly and he does go. But, you know, and it's Fearless Hooper who goes in and sees Ben Gardner's damaged boat, which delivers one of the greatest jump scares in the history of cinema. Do you remember what that was like in the cinema?
First time I saw that.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah. First time I saw that, man, there was like popcorn flying.
Oh, yeah. The whole theater just.
Yeah. Everybody.
And usually when people scream like that in a theater, usually it's followed by kind of nervous laughter. People kind of, it's a movie. And then they laugh at themselves. But I remember everybody was like, oh, God, what's coming? You know, like that there's something really bad coming next.
Well, yeah, you remember, like, because Hooper goes like, well, I'm going to jump in the water. And Brody's kind of like, you sure that's a good idea? And everybody's thinking like you're going to see the shark now. And you don't see the shark. It's Ben Gardner's head.
Yeah, well, and also
up,
brilliantly, you know, you don't hear the music. You don't hear the Jaws music, which makes it makes you feel like, oh, there's no shark because there's no music. You may not think that, but Spielberg has manipulated you into feeling that you're not going to probably see the shark because you don't hear it. No, you don't hear anything. So you're thinking, oh, I guess it's okay.
Right.
And then the head comes out of the hole in the boat. And that's what makes it so damn effective.
And the other little part I didn't think about, you know, I thought about the time, but it's like he pulls out that shark tooth that he drops when he gets, and the head pops out, and he's trying to tell everybody like, no, this was a big, He at that point, Hooper knew what kind of shark it was they were looking for, but he lost a tooth. So nobody, you know, the mayor and everybody else was kind of like, well, you know, where's the tooth of this thing? And
I don't think Larry would believe him even if he had the tooth. He'd probably say, yeah, you probably bought that somewhere in a museum. I don't know.
Yeah. You know, you're right. That's probable. But I think it was one of those little things they had in there that when he pulls out the tooth and he's thinking like, I remember the first time I saw it, I was still thinking the white shark is actually mm-hmm. going to show up and he's going to have a close call. I had no idea some guy's head was going to pop out of that.
Oh, yeah. That was brilliant. It's a brilliant piece of filmmaking. After a short break, we'll be back for more as David Ebert, a.k.a. the Lost Shark Guy, and I discuss the legacy of the movie Jaws, which came out in theaters in the summer of 1975, 50 years ago. I'm Dave Schloem, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now. As David Ebert, director of San Jose State's Pacific Shark Research Center, and I look back at the legacy of Steven Spielberg's masterpiece thriller, Jaws. The movie began the phenomenon of the summer blockbuster movie and is a masterwork of filmmaking. Just Spielberg's second movie, Jaws was released widely across the country 50 years ago this summer. As Spielberg has said, Richard Dreyfuss is his alter ego in the film.
Oh, okay, okay.
He kind of plays the kind of guy that Spielberg, you know, can identify with. Mm-hmm. And I think they just want, you know, out of the three, the one to die, and it has to be Quint. You know, killing off Hooper would be superfluous. You don't need to kill him.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So that's my take on it.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, can't remember what the, if, how that was, yeah, but I think you capture it fairly well about, and I think if they would have killed him off in the movie, I think people would have had a different reaction versus have him. Because I mean, it's kind of, it doesn't get talked about much, but when they're kind of at the end of the movie, when they're paddling towards shore and they're just talking about it, he goes, "So you don't like being on the water?" He goes, "No, not really." And he
can't imagine why.
Yeah. You know, they're just kind of kicking back into the shore there. That's kind of a little, it's not a commented on scene very much, but it's kind of interesting after all this horrific stuff they've been through, these two guys survive. And they're just having this very casual conversation, like they're sitting at a bar, only they're in the ocean with a couple of drums for flotation devices swimming ashore. So,
yeah. Yeah. I love that line. It's a great closing line to the film. And yeah. It's everything about the film to me is perfect. Every time I watch it, I go, oh, God, that, you know, how could you do that any better as a filmmaker? And the guy was 26 when he made it. That's also amazing.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Bruce. Because yeah. Bruce famously did not work well.
Yes. Yeah, they had a lot of problems with that whole mechanical shark. And didn't it take a dozen people to actually try to work that thing? And then they tried to work the shark. And
when they got it in salt water, I guess the salt water just screwed everything up and it just did not work. And so it led to tons of delays and frustration. There's a school of thought that in the long run, it works out beautifully because you don't see much of Bruce and less is more.
Right, right, right. And I think the other thing too is, like, again, just jumping back just briefly on the Blue Water White Death. And if people haven't seen that,
it's a great film.
Great film. That was the first one I remember seeing. But the thing in that movie, in the Blue Water White Death, is that was the first time people actually went to film a great white shark in its natural environment without killing it. And that movie came out in 1971, 4 years before Jaws. And that to me was always very revolutionary looking back on it, because at that time, 71, you're like, we're gonna go out and kill all the sharks we can. And then, but here these guys went out there and they're all well-known, you know, like you mentioned, Peter Gimble, Stan Waterman, the Rod and Valerie Taylor, you know,
not Harper
Fox. Yeah, they're all yeah. I mean, all these guys went out there to try to capture it on film. And that was, again, 4 years before Jaws. And then when they filmed Jaws, the original guy's going to try and film it and try to use, you know, locally. And they just could not get any film of white shark. The mechanical shark didn't always work well. And basically when they got down to the climactic scenes with Hooper and the cage and everything, and that's when they had to go to Australia. And I think the Rod and Valerie Taylor did the filming for that. And they put a person of, I don't know if it was a short person in the cage to make the shark look a lot bigger.
Yeah, to make it look big.
To make it look big. Yeah. And but that all that worked out, even though I don't think it was planned, a lot of that worked out to the advantage of the film. Because like you said, you didn't see the shark till well into the movie. And they only used parts of the mechanical shark Bruce because they had so many issues with it. And as you know, as I think I mentioned to you earlier, like on the design, like the you know, my former advisor, Leonard Campagna, was the guy that worked on the design of that thing. And if you saw that movie like you and I did, Dave, in 1975, that shark looked real in the movie.
Oh, yeah. I mean, scared the crap out of me.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah. And I watched the movie now and I'm kind of like, yeah, it looks a little looks a little fake. It doesn't change my opinion of the movie, but if you saw that back when we first saw that shark looked really real. It's like
very real.
Literally, yeah. Very real.
Didn't you tell me you saw, or you knew about, like, the actual Bruces that were out there? The actual, you know, mechanical models that they were, you know, like at a junkyard somewhere or something like that?
I don't know what happened to them after the movie finished. I, as I say, I know my advisor for my PhD. I didn't know him at the time, but he worked down there, because they had him down in Burbank. He went down and worked on him in Burbank with the, before this was before they put him in the water and everything, because they wanted to make sure this thing looked as real as possible. And I'd love to have been a fly on the wall watching Leonard Campagna run around with Spielberg for a couple of weeks on the whole thing. And because Leonard told me he was pretty, Spielberg really wanted to make it look as real as possible. And Leonard was the guy, he was the guy to talk to as far as shark anatomy and what they look like and everything. And, but Leonard, I knew him very well. He was a bit of an eccentric character. And so it had just been like, it'd been interesting to see those two guys running around. I don't know anything about Spielberg, but it'd been interesting to see those guys on the set trying to work on the on that movie. And again, this is, there's nothing like it before that. So they really had no, Leonard certainly had no sense of reference, like what this movie was going to turn into.
Yeah, and another thing, kind of going along with that, was Spielberg maybe naively insisting that they go actually film this on the open ocean, which caused tremendous trouble.
Yes.
As far as just from a filming production point of view, it caused all kinds of delays. It just made it very hard. But in the long run, it's what makes the film, because it's so real, because they're really out on the ocean.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I think I could imagine, like, just being out in the ocean trying to film. I mean, I just go out there to do research. I know you've been out in the ocean. It's not an easy environment to work in when you're trying to do a lot of filming like that and stuff. It can have its challenges. I think one thing too, just younger people, because obviously you and I were around in the 70s. You have to put yourself back in a, for the younger people that came or born years after Jaws, you have to put yourself back in that sort of era at the time. And which, not knowing anything about sharks really at all, it was just kind of like they were trying to get the best information they could, but nobody really knew anything about jaw or about white sharks or sharks in general. And so you have to think back to that. You have to put yourself in, it's getting harder if you were born 30 years after the movie came out, but to put yourself in that environment and to what was going on at that in that era.
It's also what makes the film genuinely scary, because unlike, Godzilla or whatever, name your monster movie, sharks are real. There are great white sharks. There are 25-foot great white sharks in the ocean. That they are a real thing, and not some imagined thing. So even though the shark in the story is definitely a little off the charts in terms of his vendetta against the orca and wanting to kill everybody, I think that also is what makes the film so scary.
Yeah, well, sure. The shark in the movie is a little bigger than, I think the largest one's about 20 or 21 feet they consider. But as I said earlier, if you see a white shark, whether it's 12 feet or 20 feet or
Yeah.
whatever, it's like it's a big effing shark. It's like it's big. And like, my attitude is, I'm about 6 foot. Anything over 6 feet's big to me. And
Oh yeah.
so on.
No, that'd scare me pretty good.
As you say, if you're there and you see a 10, 12-foot shark, it might as well be 15 feet, because it's going to be bigger than you and it can do a lot of damage, especially if you happen to be diving at the time, or in the water with it. It could be pretty scary.
Okay, I want to play a fun game.
Sure.
It's a little true or false. Okay, I got just a couple of little trivia questions for you.
Okay.
See how well you know Jaws.
I
There are eight deaths in Jaws. True or false?
think that's true.
That is true. Can you name them?
Okay, there's the I can't name the characters, but I can think of the young woman at the beginning,
Chrissy.
Chrissy, the little boy, the Kittner boy.
There's one before that.
There's one before that. Not the guy in the lagoon.
Nope.
Wait, what was the
Pippet.
oh
Here,
yeah
Pippet.
that's well that was a dog.
Dog.
Oh yeah, okay. Yeah, this is a dog. I forgot all about that. And then
Then Alex.
Ben Gardner, and then Quint.
Well, you got the guy in the rowboat in the
That's what I meant, the guy
estuary.
in the I said the
You
lagoon, the guy in the rowboat.
mentioned him.
Yeah, they got him. And then who am I missing now? There was
Well, you got to count two others. The tiger shark that they catch
oh okay
and Bruce.
Bruce,
Yeah, Bruce dies too.
Oh, that's right. I didn't even think about the tiger shark or Bruce.
I know nobody ever does, but
Okay.
that's there's a
Okay. Okay.
so yeah, but you gotta count the sharks.
Yeah.
You're a shark guy. Their lives are important.
Yeah, that's true. That's
Okay.
true. Okay.
Steven Spielberg was not there to shoot the last scene, and scenes are not filmed sequentially, so I don't know exactly what scene they had to wrap the movie, but he was not there. He was not there for the filming of the last scene. True or false?
Ah, boy. I would say false.
No, it's true. He was scared to death because he knew once the movie wrapped, everybody was so pissed off at him, they thought they were gonna just dump him in the ocean.
Oh, really?
Because it was a hard shoot, and
Oh, yeah.
he just literally didn't want to take the, like, oh God, these people are going to get me. And it became a tradition with him. He's never on set for the last scene. He famously
Interesting. I
doesn't
didn't.
show for that. It's a tradition with him,
Oh,
which is
wow.
kind of cool.
Yeah, I learned something
Okay,
about
another Spielberg one for you, true or false. He has an on-screen cameo in the film.
that. False.
That is correct. He does have a cameo, though, his voice, when you hear the call to the orca saying, Ellen Brody's on the line to talk to Chief. That's Steven Spielberg.
Okay. I knew Benchley had a cameo in there.
That's right. Peter Benchley has the cameo as the TV interviewer
Correct.
guy.
Yep.
And he does a pretty good job. Looks like a believable TV guy.
Yeah.
All right. You did pretty good, man. You
Thanks.
know your jaws.
Well, hopefully. I have to say, because maybe it's because it's been around so long. Every time I watch it, sometimes if I haven't seen it for a few years and I'll watch it, it'll come on or something, I'll watch it. I always pick up like, God, I didn't remember that scene or that thing. Just, little
That's
thing.
what makes movies like Jaws so fun is that, even though you know everything that's going to happen and everything, you pick out those little nuggets that you maybe didn't notice before.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite scene from the movie? There's so many, but do you have one favorite?
I got to come back to one a lot of people talk about, the Indianapolis scene we talked about. That's probably still, like, I thought it was a pretty cool scene at the time. And just the way Robert Shaw delivered the line, I think it was the dynamic between Shaw and Hooper, or I just thought that dynamic there
So cool. Yes.
was very cool. It was well done. And as I said, I think the guys had been drinking, well, Robert Shaw obviously, but I'm pretty sure the other guys were having a few.
Well, they're comparing their scars,
Yeah.
and Hooper sticks his leg up on the table, and then the really funny part in that scene is you notice that Brody's standing apart. He looks down at his appendectomy scar, and then you see him come to the realization. It's like, no, this isn't good enough to share with these two. This does not rank.
I thought when Hooper goes, like, points at his chest, and he goes, this is where I can't
She
remember her
broke.
name, broke my heart.
She broke my heart. That's funny. Yeah. But the neat thing, a great piece of acting by Hooper is you see, and we all come to this realization when he makes the, when he says the Indianapolis, and then you see Hooper go from goofy, funny, drunken guy to his instant
Right.
recall. If he knows the story of the Indianapolis and he just turns it, you are on the Indianapolis. And then after that monologue, now we understand why Quint is the way he is. That's what makes that scene so
Yep.
brilliant.
Yep. Exactly. Yep. And I think, yeah, you bear up a good point when Hooper goes, like, you were on the, his whole, everything just changes. He just softens up and he's just like, you were on the Indianapolis. It was just, and of course, Brody didn't have any idea what he was talking about, but that was kind of, I thought that was kind of like, again, it gets back to the three characters you have there. One guy who lived it, one guy who knows about it, one guy who had no idea what he was talking about.
One of my favorite scenes, and I would have to say that's the greatest scene in the movie is the monologue. But my favorite one that makes me crack up every time is when they have the tiger shark hanging up, and Hooper's, checking out the jaw diameter and stuff because he knows the bite radius and all that. He's figured out this is not the shark. And he says to these guys that caught it, and this is a tiger shark. And the guy goes, a what? The way he says it and looks like such an idiot just cracks me up every time.
Yeah, I think one thing I'd have to say, though, and again, I don't know if they're local fishermen, they probably got some kind of idea what it is, although tiger sharks are kind of rare up in that area. But I mean, I'm talking about guys that fish all the time, not sort of the weekend guys. But then I think a lot of the way, yeah, but you're right, that scene, he kind of goes, oh, what?
Well, your final thoughts on Jaws at 50? What does Jaws really mean to you, if you can sum it up 50 years on?
I think it was a landmark movie. Obviously, it was a blockbuster, the first blockbuster, but I think it was a landmark movie, and it really, to me, it paved the way for modern shark research. That movie, I wouldn't be here today doing what I'm doing if it wasn't for that movie.
Well, that's an excellent way to end it. Well, David Ebert, shark expert extraordinaire and a fellow Jaws fan,
Yep.
thanks for joining us to talk about this. This was really fun.
Thanks again, Dave, for having me on the show. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks again to our guest, Director of San Jose State University's Pacific Shark Research Center at Moss Landing Marine Labs, David Ebert. You can learn more about their work at mlml.sjsu.edu/psrc and visit David's website at lostsharkguide.com. And Steven Spielberg, if you're listening, thanks for a really cool movie. I know I've watched it at least 50 times in the last 50 years. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.